that they weren't showing off, and they got the job friggin' done. So I think that's the problem today. There's too many people who think they're too clever, and they're coming up with all these gee whiz moments that are going to slow the progress of engineering a proper vehicle for decades to come. I mean, hopefully Jeff Bezos isn't into this much for his ego. So I'm expecting better things from Jeff Bezos, but we'll see.
Yeah, you won't need a dozen refuels with the Jeff Bezos system. You know, he'll launch it from Earth. It'll go into lunar orbit. It'll stay there with fuel. Liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, go down to the surface, come back up. No refueling. But now, when it does the next trip down, yes, then it will need to be refueled. They'll have to send out a tanker that Jeff Bezos is designing and, you know, filled with fuel and oxygen to refuel his Blue Moon lander. But at least, you know, that's okay. But there's other thing, Starship, and it's in orbit around the Earth. You're going to need, they say, up to 10 refills, 10 other Starships that are going to have to launch to refill this thing before it leaves orbit to go to the moon. You know, I don't get that. That's you know, and then they're going to land on the moon with this 150-foot tall thing. You know, 27 feet in diameter. You know, to put two people on the moon with some kind of elevator system. You know, a cable that's going to lower them down. It's 14 stories that they'll have to go down to land on the moon and come back up. It's really a lot of wild ideas that they put together that they somehow sold NASA on. I mean, NASA did, like Rich said, they put billions of dollars into it. It's not a time and material job. It's anything after that, he's supposed to, you know, be paying for it. You know, so like Rich said, they've used up their NASA money already. Back to you, Rich.
Yeah, I mean, the one true skill Elon has is to milk money out of the government. Albany gave him $1 billion to build a battery factory in New York State. There's no battery factory in New York State, but he got the $1 billion, and that's kind of, I guess, all that counts. Usually it's either government or venture capitalists who made way too much money on things like PayPal and Facebook and all those things, and don't mind wasting billions of dollars on eWorks and Elon's pipe dreams and such. So I don't know. And by the way, I don't know about you, but I discovered this refueling with 10 tanks in space only about 6 months ago. Up until then, the way that SpaceX was driving it was that it would get refueled in space, but there was no number 10 attached to it at all. And I think most people assumed it was one or two or something, which is a lot easier to do, I guess, or at least one fifth as troublesome as 10.
Yeah, I know. You got away with that one. You know, maybe if he could launch two or three right away, but he's not going to be able to do that. I mean, that's what he's thinking. That's why it's going to take 10. It's all going to vaporize. They have to keep the pressure low inside these vehicles. You can't put liquid oxygen in a tank and close the valve and let it heat up to 250 degrees, you know, when it's in the sun in orbit. I used to cut a cutting torch my whole life. I had an oxygen tank. They were the green tanks. And the steel had to be probably an inch thick wall on those tanks, filled up with oxygen. And 3,000 pounds, over 3,600 pounds per square inch inside that tank. And why? Because, you know, the valve was closed off. But it was a steel, you know, heavy wall tank, you know. So these things that he's flying up there with these stainless steel bodies are extremely thin. They can't hold the pressure. You know, they could hold all these gallons of liquid oxygen and fuel, you know, they can hold the weight, but they can't hold the pressure. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, there's just so many engineering problems yet to be solved. I believe when they started to open the Pez dispenser as a test, they vented a lot of fuel into space, and I think that was what gave the rocket a sin. Because when it was coming down, it wasn't coming down in the right direction. It was coming down at an off angle to its heat shields. It was a mess. I mean, you know, they portrayed it as a great a success, but it really wasn't. There were so many different things that were kind of half-assed and some things that just went terribly wrong. So, you know, I mean, they might be able to fix it, given enough money and maybe 20 years, but I think everyone's going to move on from SpaceX only for that. And, you know, I don't know what's going to become of their satellite systems and Starlink, because it's still not cost effective. So actually almost nothing that he touches is cost effective. Perhaps Tesla, but Tesla is inflated, and I think they're dropping prices because they're actually going to have competition. So I don't know. I've always had this idea that this is going to be Theranos Mark II, but we'll see what time tells. Rich, did you get your answer to your question, or you still have some aspects that you think we haven't resolved yet?
Bob, you beat me to the with the next comment.
Well, I hear in Paul's voice that he has some doubts, or a lot of doubts, about what's going on. And I guess it's one of those questions that really can't be answered, because who knows what's going on in all those brilliant minds. But it sure doesn't make sense to me at all. I got a great idea. Why don't we build a rocket that doesn't have to be refueled, that can go right to the moon? Oh, wait, we did that 60 years ago. Forget that one, then. It's just crazy what's going on. And I guess the next couple of years will indicate a direction that all this is going. I hope so. Anyway, that's about it, Roy. Thanks. Back to you.
You're welcome. By the way, Frank recognized. I hear you on Echolink. We'll get to you in 1 second. Frank, I think the significant difference is Apollo was designed as an exploration on the basis of science and showing the Soviets who's the smarter engineer out there. This is kind of based on reuse and cost effectiveness, which is kind of, again, dubious as far as I'm concerned. I think people are just kind of being terribly optimistic about it being cost effective. You know, going to other planets at this point, they're not cost effective. They're a bit of scientific bravado, and I like bravado as much as the next guy. Anyway, Frank, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, a couple of comments. First of all, I think this that is moving propellant between the two tanks was actually paid for by NASA, justified as a test needed to develop refueling for the human landing system, the HLS. So it is kind of a backdoor way of subsidizing Starship. That's my understanding of what's going on there. Now, the Starlink situation is interesting. First of all, you remember back in January, I actually did come on the net using a Starlink convention. Technically, it works. It's expensive, yes. My wife let me get away with paying for the service for another reason. But in any case, it was fun and it worked. Now, supposedly, NASA Space Flight Channel, those guys believe that Starlink, that the Falcon 9 is now quite profitable because they're charging customers supposedly something like $70 million per launch, and since they're getting everything back, reusing them again and again. They're making money on it, supposedly. One other comment is that Tory Bruno, I think Marcus House, is it Marcus House or one of the other guys interviewed him sometime back, called Starship an LEO or LEO truck. That is, I think his main purpose is to just cart a huge number of Starlinks and other satellites into low Earth orbit. Some people think within a year, SpaceX will at least have a disposable system that can do that. And of course, if they do get reusability working, some people think that would lower the cost of launch by 100. Is it really meant for Moon or Mars exploration? There's no business case for that. I've heard Neil deGrasse Tyson say that in an interview, and he has a good point. There's no business case for exploration. Anyway, that's my 2 cents, whatever it's worth. I'm no expert. WB2GXL.
AC2GS. Well, I thank you, Frank. A business can lose billions of dollars and make a profit in one little subset of what they do. You know, if they're launching other people's stuff, they might make a profit. A lot of their ships are launching Starlink satellites, which isn't making them any profit. And again, you have the situation where, you know, I mean, some things are real nifty, but they're not cost effective. Satellite phones were not cost effective, and so I think the government bailed them out, and there's still a small group of business, but you know, they're not making the money they hoped. There were those two satellite EO stations that both of them almost went bankrupt until one bought the other, and they're hobbling along. So there's a whole bunch of business models that don't really particularly work out, and some take a little bit longer to fall apart than others. So, you know, the problem is that most of the money is in high population areas. Low population areas have far less people, obviously. But low population areas are the best places for satellite Starlinks because large population can afford to run fiber and do it at a lot cheaper price. So ultimately, I don't see, other than war-torn areas and cruise ships or something, there's not enough people out there with enough demand willing to pay a lot of money to maintain these very expensive subsystems. So, you know, I'm not an economist, and I don't play one on the radio, but, you know, I think it's kind of a gee whiz neato idea that I'm sure a lot of other country has people who want to put billions of dollars into it, but I think it's ultimately a failed technology until or unless propulsion science, you know, all you got to do is come up with an anti-gravity device and inertial dampeners, and then all these things will be cost effective.
Yeah, what I think it needs is nucleothermal, as they call it, to distinguish it from thermonuclear, in other words, a nuclear engine, to get what I think they call a specific impulse, so you can get huge amounts of thrust you need to send humans to Mars in a reasonable period of time. Chemical engines just aren't going to cut it. There's not enough energy there. You're probably a lot more expert on that than I am, Gareth.
Yeah, I agree with you. The present chemistry of propulsion science is smack dab at the beginning of the 20th century. All these rocket fuels are things that chemists knew in the 1800s. They might have tweaked them in the 1900s, but that's about it. You know, nothing is new. You know, they don't have matter-antimatter drives like they do on starships, the Enterprise and such. So, you know, I mean, I love space. I love science. You know, I went through my childhood reading stuff that NASA would mail me as public relations stuff and loving every minute of it. But, you know, you have to kind of understand that there's an underlying economics to science, ultimately, and you can't make believe it isn't fair. So, you know, I'm not terribly optimistic, and I don't really understand why you need a colony on Mars at this point. Again, the economics don't make sense, and the incredible danger of killing everyone, which is a bad public relations move. You want to kill a project? Kill all of the people who are in charge of explore it. That'll kill it rather quickly. I don't know. Maybe I'm just a cynical guy.
Well, I think one view is that the real purpose of Starship is just to cart a huge amount of cargo, 120,000 tons in one small swoop, as my mom would say, into low Earth orbit. And that's incredible, and that in itself would be a game changer, and the real game changer if they can get the parts back and reuse them, the customer can get their deposit back, so to speak. The exploration thing, that may be just weak bank public relations. The real purpose is to make money carting satellites up there in all likelihood. Go ahead.
Okay, but I mean, there's a price to be paid for too many satellites. Astronomers already are about to put out a contract on Elon because he's made it more difficult for them to look at the sky without seeing reflecting Starlink satellites. And, you know, there's some situation where, you know, one satellite bangs into another, which is like a billiard table. That one bangs into another, and before you know it, you know, a thousand satellites are wrecked and out of orbit. So, I don't know. I think there's a kind of limitation on each orbit of how many damn satellites you could in that particular orbit, and I don't think we're going to learn it until there's some kind of small disaster up there.
Roy, WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I don't want to double with Frank. There's an app I put on my phone, Stellarium, and it's an astronomy program. You know, it's very good. You hold it up, and you can point it in every direction, and in the distance you can see, okay, I'm looking at S for south, or W for west, and as you move it around, you know, you're going to see all the different stars and planets, wherever they are. It tells you what star is what. You know, you just click on it, click on what, you know, if you click on one and it's a planet, it will tell you what planet it is, give you the whole history. It's a very good program. But one of the things you do with it, you could zoom in, you know, closer and closer, to see other stars. But as you zoom in, you see little things moving, little lights moving, little tiny comets, and you zoom in closer, and then sure enough, they show up as satellites, little satellites with, you know, a solar panel sticking out of it, and they're constantly moving. So as you click on them, it'll tell you it's Starlink number 2250. Here's another one. It's Starlink 1180. All these little lights that are moving no matter which way you face this thing, are all Starlink satellites. You know, once in a while you click on one, and, you know, it might be a Russian satellite or a Chinese satellite or something. But 99% of them are all these Starlink satellites. He's got over 5,000 of those things flying around up there right now, Roy.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone's interested, Wiki the Kessler Syndrome, that's like the worst billiard game in the universe. It's when there's any closely positioned satellites in the same orbit that if one kind of moves out of position, it's like a messy billiard game. Frank, you want to respond or said what you wanted to say? Are you out there, Frank? Well, I don't know.
You don't show him on Echolink anymore, Brian?
No, I do see him on Echolink, but sometimes there's a delay. I remember a couple of weeks ago when Echolink crashed, everyone was still listed as being there because Echolink had crashed so badly that it didn't even reset its what it thought it was connected to. So I hope that hasn't happened again.
No,
no, Echolink is
fine,
boy.
Too far away from the phone to answer you.
So, surely, what the future
kind of
holds
incredible.
Up
I
there
mean,
in space.
And I think you're right.
Paul, thanks for thanks to your lovely SpaceNet report, because it's all, I know it's all it takes a lot of study during the week
of the FM
that
do
that. So
they're also
I really
salivating at the idea of
I'm sure all of us
huge,
do. Back to you,
a huge space telescope in the payload bay of a starship, and not have to figure out how to fold a mirror origami style to fit it into a small ferry. The idea of being able to just put a huge huge space telescope in there and have it launched is something that I think for some of them really think is a fantastic idea. Go ahead.
Okay. Frank, unfortunately, you partially doubled with Rich. I didn't know that you could double on Echolink, but you learn something new every day.
I know. Echolink doesn't allow you to double.
Kind of got my 2 cents in there. Anyway, WB2BN.
Okay, well, that was interesting because you doubled again with Rich. But I understood both of you. That's the beauty of this kind of doubling. It seems to be 50-50. So I listen to one person with my left ear and the other one with the right. Let me see. Someone seems to be throwing a carrier or something. So let me take a little pause. Yeah, it's just someone throwing a carrier or something noisy. Anyway, well, okay, we kind of knocked that around, I'm glad to see you on Echolink, Frank, because maybe we could bring up and then shut it down, because I've been wanting to discuss great circles for I think about a month now. So I have the illustration up on Roy's link. Again, you just type into your computer or your cell phone browser, roy.ac2gs.com, and it has a nice little illustration, hopefully, of what a great circle is, what a short path is, and what a long path is. So what would you like to bring up to the subject, Frank?
Okay, very good. I had to dry my hands. To get to the phone. All right, I'm not going to be able to take a look at it right now, but I'm glad you put that up because I think there are a lot of people on Wixie who kind of don't get the concept that radio signals kind of don't travel around the world from east to west. They go to these great circles, and really kind of have to get that to kind of have an idea what propagation is doing. Anyway, I will be listening. WB2BX.
Okay, is AC2GS as always. So let me give you a little rundown as best I can of the concept, and if anyone has any questions or feels that I'm leading people astray, feel free. Basically, think of the Earth as a perfect sphere. I realize it's an oblong object. It's kind of squeezed down at the poles and kind of fat at the equator. But for the sake of simplification, consider it a sphere. Now, intersect it with a plane. The place where the plane intersects the sphere, the edges define a circle. The closer the plane gets to intersecting the center of the sphere, the larger the circle gets. When you intersect the sphere with a plane at the center of the Earth, it is the largest circumference circle. That's a great circle. Now, you can rotate that plane as long as it keeps on intersecting the sphere. All the circles that are defined by the intersection are all great circles. They are all the largest circle that you can form from the intersection of a sphere with a plane. So those are great circles. Now, if you have a location that you're transmitting and a place that you want to receive you, and you position the plane along that portion of the sphere, that defines the great circle for that communication. The two points in the direction closest from each other is the short path. That's the shortest path to get from your location to the person you're trying to transmit to. The rest of the circle that's defined that isn't the short path is what we call the long path. That's the long way around, because things go around and around the Earth. They just don't fly out into outer space. So the shortest path is the short portion of the great circle, and the long path is the longer portion of the great circle. So hopefully that helps a little bit. The picture hopefully is very helpful. So if you have an opportunity, type in roy.ac2gs.com and take a look at the very first image, and hopefully you will understand the difference between short path, long path, and the great circles. Any comments, questions? Yes, Ed.
Wait a minute, there's somebody
else. No, I'm responding to Ed. Now we have
terminology. If the two points you're talking about, short path or long path, are exactly halfway around and it's a tie, when the long path and the short path are the same, is there any name for that?
Not to my knowledge, because I think it tends to be a rarity.
And a slightly off topic tangent?
Certainly.
A lot of people don't realize, if you are flying on a commercial flight, say from New York to London, and you plot the path on a Mercator, you know, classic XY projection, you'll see it's an arc that goes all the way to the north. Because if you take the globe and a piece of string, you will see that is the shortest path. And on a Mercator projection, it appears to be this big loop.
Well, yeah, I mean, the problem is that it's very difficult to accurately portray a three-dimensional object on two-dimensional paper. So you introduce some agreed-upon distortion. This is why a lot of kids foolishly think that Greenland and Iceland are enormous countries. When it's kind of obvious that as you get to the North and the South Pole, the distortion becomes greater and greater. But, yeah, that's the problem with Mercator maps. Everyone has one. They're much more common than actual globes. They were very popular in school when I was a child. They were very popular in some libraries, but they're few and far between.
Yeah, that's my point exactly, yes.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully by the time we all get to be of a certain age, we understand that the two-dimensional that we take for granted are distortions, that you know, there's just no way to properly give you an illustration of a three-dimensional object in two-dimensional space. You know, eventually with modern technology, we'll be able to project globes in our eyeglasses and such. But until then, that's probably the reason why. Also, unfortunately, I forget right now that there's a path that is kind of straight on a map that rhomboid, I forget exactly what it's called. I'm sure you know it. That sometimes is used because it's just a little easier, and if it's a short distance from one to the other, the difference between the shortest path and doing it the other way is not really that much as far as gas uses. You remember the name for that path, Ed?
No, what you're saying does not ring a bell. Either I do not know what you're talking about, or I do, but I'm not recognizing it from your description.
Okay, I guess I'm not explaining it as well as I should.
It stays in...
Yes?
NY2H. Great Circle versus Rumline, R-H-U-B-M, Rumline.
Thank you very much, Lou. I knew it started with Rum, but I probably should have stopped at that. So, yeah, Rumline is actually rectilinear. It kind of makes believe that the meridian maps are legitimate. And just because, getting there is a little bit easier on the instrumentation, I've heard, and if it's a short distance, the distance between the short path and the ROM path is inconsequential. So, yeah, when I was looking up long path and great circles and such, ROM path showed its face. So that's another little interesting thing.
WS2N?
Yes, Paul.
In my shack, I have a big map on a wall, and it shows Greenland about twice the size, a little bit bigger than twice the size of the United States. But then next to it, I have an actual globe, and Greenland in reality is less than one third the size of the United States. Fun to look at.
Yeah, good for you. I kind of always wanted a globe, and for some strange reason, never got around to buying one. I guess ultimately there were too many options when I kept on looking at things. You know, there are old styles and new styles and dark colors and bright colors and all kinds of things. I never got around to it. But, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that hopefully most of us nowadays takes for granted. But, you know, I'm sure when we were little kids, if we didn't have a globe available, a lot of people got a very wrong idea about, you know, I mean, I would assume that people think that Africa is about 15 times the size of every other continent.
Roy?
Yes, Ed?
I think the problem with globes is if a globe didn't have countries and stuff like that on it, it would be more popular because globes, obviously, are much, much more expensive than a sheet of paper map. The problem is, periodically, the political map changes, and no one is going to throw away a 2-foot diameter globe and buy a new one every time some borderline changes. So that's a damper on people getting globes.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's a problem. Sometimes it's a bigger problem than other times. Nowadays, countries usually don't kind of go in and out of existence, but they do change their name, and so the labels are all wrong. The way to sort of get around it when I was contemplating a globe would be a more historical globe. So it would be something that's already out of date, but historically it continues to be accurate. You know, some kind of globe circa the 1900s or the 1800s or the 1700s or something a little bit more historical where, you know, the labels are less useful and you can probably get away with it more than, you know, last century's accurate globe.
And does your imagined globe have New Amsterdam on it?
Well, I guess it depends upon what century you buy it for. I'm sure there are classic globes that have New Amsterdam listed where we live. I would assume, though, most either have New York or they go so far back that they don't have any kind of name other than, you know, maybe a couple for the entirety of North America.
That brings up another off-topic, WB2AV.
Certainly.
Want me to dive headfirst into magnetic declination?
Fun time?
That permission to proceed?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't realize is magnetic north. The magnetic north pole is not quite the actual North Pole. The actual North Pole is the center of rotation of the planet. Magnetic North Pole actually slowly moves. You hear it, but it's not quite there, and it does vary. Now, what happens is they put out correction factors with compasses, but they vary with where you are. So magnetic declination on a, sometimes is printed on a map. It's only good over a relatively small area, and eventually it does change with time. As I understand, the magnetic North Pole today is in northern Canada, and I think in about another 50 or 60 years, it's supposed to go very, very close to the real North Pole, and then continue somewhere into northern Russia, and then the crystal ball clouds over. But when you're trying to use the compass precisely, it's very, very difficult and be very, very frustrating. But the good news is these days, when people are using compasses, you know, they're just periodically resetting things. You know, you retweak periodically so it doesn't take you too far off course.
Well, and also GPS technology has gotten so much better. My understanding was that the rate of updating the location of the magnetic North Pole had to be increased. It was changing at a more rapid pace than it had been in previous decades. So they had to issue corrections more frequently. And, you know, all the geologists are scurrying around trying to figure out what the heck's going on there with the... you know, our magnetic poles are due to rotating liquid conductive iron that's kind of sloshing around right above in a kind of crust over the subcore. So it's magnetohydrodynamics and such at play.
Yeah, well, that's what the problem is. You know, the Earth is not a solid rock. And there are all kinds of variations that come into play there. But let me point out one thing. You mentioned GPS. Flying an airplane, nowadays they use a lot of GPS stuff. Problem is, it does not really tell you very well what direction you are heading. It tells you that you can use it and program a computer running off of it to tell you the direction you're going, but not the direction you're heading. Whereas airplanes usually depend very heavily on compasses to keep them pointing where you want. Now keep in mind, where you're pointing and where you're going are close, but they often do not align perfectly. So it's a rather complicated thing.
Well, good. Thank you for pointing that out. My experiences and airplanes are somewhat limited. So that's good. You know, it's kind of fascinating how technology shapes us. You know, most of the time, the one thing that kind of sort of confused me is the North Pole is not a magnetic North Pole. The North Pole is a magnetic South Pole because magnetic South Pole attracts a compass that's aligned with magnetic north. So it's kind of a weird world we live in where our magnetic North Pole is actually a South Pole versus vice versa.
Are you sure of that, Roy? I always thought it is a true magnetic north, and the compasses, you know, the red painted part of the pointer is actually a South Pole for the very reason you mentioned. But I have absolutely no proof that's true. It's possible you are true. Do you have any evidence that your side of the equation is correct?
Well, yeah. Ultimately, we're kind of touching on good old Albert's theory of relativity. It depends on your frame of reference. I mean, the North Pole is on the north end of how we describe our Earth. But if you look at there's lots of magnets out there that actually have listed N and S, and if you play around with magnets that listed N and S, the S portion of the magnet is going to attract the same portion of your compass. So I guess you could theoretically say that every labeled magnet is wrong and the North Pole is the North Pole, or you could flip it and say the North Pole is really a South Pole and the South Pole is really a North Pole, and all the poles that are listed on commercial magnets are correct, are wrong. So, you know, it's relative. It depends on what you want to take the reference for. If you want to take the reference for every magnet known to mankind that has an NRS on it versus the idea that the magnet in the north, near the North Pole, is a North Pole magnet.
I am not so sure you'd want to play that game very cavalierly. I don't think you'd want to bring a permanent magnet too near a compass for possible, you know, for danger of, you know, for, you know, changing the magnetization of a compass needle.
Well, you know, I mean, we both lived through a period of time when magnets weren't neodymium, and I had many weak magnets in my childhood. That probably would be problematic of even changing the magnetic polarization of a compass needle. You know, when I was a kid, I played with cheap, very weak magnets. So I still think in terms of those, even though I own some lovely neodymium super magnets.
Are you saying the latest compasses, neodymium ion boron pointers?
Not at all. I'm just pointing out that screwing up a compass with a magnet is a little bit more difficult with a magnet from the 1960s as opposed to a magnet from today. The Teslas of a neodymium magnet are orders of magnitude greater than the cheap 50-cent bar magnets I had when I was a kid.
I assume you're referring to NID, neodymium iron boron.
When I'm talking about modern-day type of super magnets, yes, that is what I'm describing. There are other magnet technologies that come somewhat close, but again, they were all incredibly expensive or non-existent when I was a kid.
Yeah, I think the hot thing when I was in middle school was Alnico.
Yeah, aluminum nickel. Yeah, they were fine. And, you know, when I was a kid, I did everything that you would imagine a kid would do. I used to put magnets, put a piece of paper over a magnet and sprinkle some iron filings and to demonstrate the magnetic flux lines coming out of the magnet.
You know, from the way you tell it, you're an incredibly curious maniac. I'm very pleased you didn't blow yourself up.
Oh, I used to make explosives too, by the way.
I'm even more impressed that you're still here.
Well, I tried to be cautious about it, and also I didn't go crazy. You know, sometimes people get delusions of grandeur, and, you know, you could make a couple of grams of stuff, and it goes pop. And then eventually some not terribly bright people ultimately say, yeah, I wonder what would happen if I make a half a pound of this stuff. And then they kind of lose fingers and toes and all kinds of very necessary things. So I tried to keep it to a minimum just to get the results. And I used them outdoors instead of indoors. And I tended to hopefully be aware of the power that different explosives had. I particularly liked a compound that you could set it on fire and it would just sit there and look at you. You could stomp on it and it would just sit there and look. If you put one drop of water in the damn thing, all of a sudden you have a smoke bomb. So I was a big fan of that, but I never mixed it in large quantities. It didn't age well. And to this day, I'm sort of surprised. We lived in a much kinder world where if I had tried to do it in this decade, the FBI would probably be knocking on my door right now to say night.
You don't have to go that far. I joke around that one of the reasons why I still am active in the Boy Scouts is when I go out in the woods with the Boy Scouts and I'm teaching them axemanship, you know, everybody smiles. If I was out in the woods with the same axe but without the Boy Scouts, I'd probably get arrested.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. I still remember when I was a little kid, I had kind of exhausted the hobby shop supply of chemicals, and I wanted to try new and interesting ones. And I found some chemistry shop in downtown Brooklyn. My father, thankfully, was didn't realize how dangerous I was, apparently. And he, I had all kinds of lovely chemicals. I used to love my chemistry set. I made all kinds of fun stuff and survived. You know, it was probably more dangerous in my college chemistry classes than my home chemistry classes, home chemistry lab. I didn't have things like asbestos or otherwise at home, and we had loads of asbestos over at NYU.
I assume you never played with mixtures of saltpeter, charcoal, and sulfur, or with nitrocellulose.
Well, I'm sure you're kidding, because, of course, making nitrocellulose, which was, I think, one of the early plastics. They made the billiard balls, and they made film stock out of nitrocellulose. And, of course, the other one is good old gunpowder, which was loads of fun to play with. Again, in moderation, all things in moderation.
And as I understand, he tried nitrotoluene. If you throw in a fire, it burns nicely like pine. Just do not want to hook it up to a detonator, because what happens is, I believe it's called sympathetic detonation. A detonator going off will set it off, but you can, hammer it, throw in the fire, everything. Without a detonator, it's perfectly safe.
Yeah, I never really played with trinitro, toluene, good old TNT. I didn't play with nitroglycerin either. Nitroglycerin has a great story. Nitroglycerin is a ridiculously unstable compound. If you make it, you're probably a little bit crazy. Because the chances of it going bad is very high. And it was a very poor fellow who mixed it with Cretaceous earth, I think it is, and made it stable, so that dynamite, he called it. He made millions and millions of dollars, and his name was Nobel, and he's the guy who put some of his explosive profits into the Nobel Prizes, including the Nobel Peace Prize.
Stephen writes that he'd kill for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Okay, that's a good line.
That makes him a militant pacifist?
I guess so. Well, now we're just getting downright silly, and I thank you all for getting silly with me. And I hope you learned a couple of things, but not how to make explosives. And I really didn't go into detail about how to make anything. Just some old war stories. So, don't let your children make explosives is I guess, the ultimate message tonight. Find out what they're doing, and if they're doing something absurd, tell them not to do it anymore. Thankfully, my parents never did that. I got to fix TVs when I was in fifth grade. No one was afraid I was going to electrocute myself or anything like that. And I played with chemicals all the time, and no one was afraid that I was going to blow myself up. So I guess we were all lucky. So thanks, everyone. Let's move on. Unless anyone has something else to say on this subject, we'll move on.
Hello, Ricky. I heard you calling, so I'm coming in to say hello.
Okay, who's Richie?
Oh, Richie,
okay.
Do you copy? Richie, do you copy 470 coming in to say hello?
470 is not a proper call sign, sir. You don't have a proper call sign, you cannot use the repeater. Anyway, let's move on. Wesley, you had some subjects you wanted to talk about tonight. By by the way, the guy sitting on the his transmitter, I guess he can't hear me because he's sitting on his transmitter. I have a direct line with the repeater. So, you know, you can do that, or you can bang your head with it, or all kinds of things. It really doesn't affect my transmission one iota. So find yourself some better way of spending your night. I could think of some things, both FCC approved and other things that are not FCC approved, but I leave it to you. Anyway, Wesley, did you want to bring up some topics tonight? Wesley, are you out there? Wesley, are you out there?
WSUN.
Yes, Paul?
Can you hear me now? Okay. Go ahead. Go to Wesley. That's okay.
No. Okay, I can hear you now, Wesley. When I was a kid making explosives and tinkering around with high power, high voltage devices, I think it was a constructive time spent. This is sort of an example of a very unconstructive time being spent. Anyway, Wesley, if you could point your Yagi a little bit closer to the repeater or something and cut through this background, please try. Rather challenging. Paul, what did you want to say earlier? Maybe we can get that part out and then kind of see what happens.
Okay, I'm going to sit up. I'm still back with the compass. If you were standing on a North Pole and you had a regular compass and you wanted to find out if you wanted to go back in the direction of, let's say, New York from the North Pole, and you only had a compass, they spin you around so you don't know which direction you're facing. It's a cloudy day, so you're not even sure where the sun is. You know, would you be able to find your direction? You know, I'm trying to make a little riddle out of this one. Anyway, back to you.
Have a comment on that.
Say again, Ed.
I have a comment. Let me get to the point. I assume Paul means just standing on the magnetic North Pole, and I believe the answer is no. You have no, your compass is useless. Because if you're at the true North Pole, offset from the magnetic north, and if you know where magnetic north is, you can get a heading and work from there.
Yeah, Dr. Ray, am I coming out?
This is the first time I heard you in the last 5 minutes. So the rest of the time, you're not coming out. It depends on the spirit in the air screwing around with the repeater.
Oh, okay. No, I was just responding. So if you're ready, you can talk. And can you hear me now? Did somebody put a carrier on me?
Yeah, I can hear you even with that. I just want to tie up some loose that we went to while we waited for you to get your signal up. So I sort of agree with Ed, Paul. What's the solution to the puzzle?
Oh, okay. Yeah, and by the way, I was standing on true north. I wasn't standing on magnetic north. So the answer would be, of course, yes. I could find my way back to New York. Just like Ed said, you'd be pointing to central Canada. I think it's like, I don't know, 300 to 400 miles away. But you'd be pointing to central Canada. So with that, you could figure out if you want to go back to New York. Or for that matter, if you want to go to Siberia. But at least we know it would work if you're standing on true north. Back to you, Bruce.
Very good. I like that question. Also, keep in mind that due to the nature of the source of our magnetic poles, being magnetohydrodynamics, every so often there's a reversal field. So there will come a time that if you travel deep enough into the future, not that long actually, but deep into the future, your compass will be pointing in the exact opposite direction. It will be pointing down south. Anyway, Wesley, what do you want to bring up today?
Okay. So the first one was the Hyperloop, the Dutch Hyperloop test center, 750 kilometers per hour, so it's 500 whatever miles per hour. Your comment, Dr. Roy.
Well, my comment is a fool and his money is easily parted. The Hyperloop is nonsense. Hyperloop, as you kind of sent me a Wikipedia that has been discussed for 70, 80 years. You know, we basically pulled it out of a popular science cover article from the 1960s or 1970s. We do not have the technological prowess to do it. It's ridiculously expensive and wouldn't really work for most people's purposes. So we got a real knucklehead here.
Okay, so it's 420 meters wide.
Anybody going along the
railway line in the Windschip Northern Netherlands. And yes, I agree with you. So 700 kilometers per hour pressure tube is probably waste of the money. And let's go to the next one.
Wesley?
Yes.
Yeah, you were doubling with Lou. Lou, what did you want to say?
NY2H, that interference is coming in on Selden. So anybody can listen on Selden input can hear, get a location on this guy.
Okay, very good. As you all know, you can send your findings to RFI at LIMARC.org. They keep records of these things. So, Wesley, what do you want to say now?
Okay, so the next topic, we're gonna go quick on it. The next topic was that commercial. So, a lady, there is the Lexi Alford. She traveled through all the entire world using electric Ford Explorer designed for European customers. And, of course, she did it. So, that was the F-150 e-transit that was e-transit, so I have a transit, but it's 150, but it's not electric. What is your comment about it? So it's 27 countries and 30,000 kilometers on electric power alone. Back to you.
Okay, I mean, it's a PR ploy. I'd like to know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars in people following her around with something chargeable through her entire course cost. I think that Tesla did that with a Roadster back in 2016 or something. You know, it's a public relations thing. I mean, you can't extrapolate that to reality. If you buy one, you're not going to be able to just kind of pell-mell drive around the world and find a power source every place.
Okay. The next one is, study shows avoiding consumption of protein building block isoleucin increases lifespan. So it was found, of course it was advertised, 33% longer lifetime if you don't do it, if you don't use it. But it was tested the mice. So a diet low of isoleucine prolonged the lifespan of male mice by 33% and female by 7%. Your comment?
Well, if you happen to be a mouse out there, congratulations on getting your license. This might be for you. For the humans, not so much. Besides, what this really goes back to is if you take laboratory mice and starve them, they have a longer lifespan. The ones that don't die from being weak and feeble from